dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Every once in a while, we get to present some intelligence of a very important kind through the miracle of terrific filmmaking. And this is one of those occasions. Our guest is Matthew Taylor. He is a very accomplished filmmaker with some 30 documentaries to his credit, addressing a whole host of issues, notably of late, political corruption and its implications for our country and its future. The most recent of these is a film entitled Riding the Dragon, the Biden's China Secrets. I had the privilege of viewing it the other day. It is now available for free online, and I commend Matt and his colleague Peter Schweitzer, the author of the book Clinton Cash, on which this particular film is largely based. It is a superb documentary film and could not be more timely, as Americans are now finally thinking about, no kidding, who do we want as our next commander-in-chief, especially as the individual who will, no matter who the choice is, have to deal with communist China and the party that rules it as job one for the next term of the presidency of the United States. Matt Taylor, it is terrific to have you with us. Thank you very much for this film and the chance to visit with you a little bit about it. Well, let's talk a little bit about it. I think of myself as in the dot connecting business here at Secure Freedom Radio and in my other capacities. I want to just take my hat off to you because I think you've done a remarkable job of connecting the dots. Particularly, both my wife and I were impressed by the visual way you did that on film of thumbtacks with yarn connecting literally the dots. Talk a little bit about sort of the thesis of Riding the Dragon and how those dots do connect in ways that are shocking.
Well, you know, what's interesting about when you have someone like the Biden family, which is a dynastic type family, similar to the Clintons, they have created a series of deals to enrich themselves through their public service space, primarily Joe Biden as the former vice president, through his son. And the thing is that when they structure these deals, they're very complicated. They're very, very twisty and windy, and there's many of them. And really, the film, in a similar way to how we did Clinton Cash in 2016, shows that it's not any one deal that is the most egregious, though some of them are quite egregious. It's the fact that this establishes a pattern, and the pattern is always the same. And the idea is that if there's a pattern at this moment of time, whether it's Burisma in Ukraine, whether it's Bohai Harvest with the Chinese government or the Chinese military, this pattern will continue and will be amped up by a million times once Joe Biden becomes president, or if he becomes president. So the film is to be looked at as this is just a series of examples of how he will be president if he obtains that position.
It's a cautionary tale, in other words, not just a retrospective on a lot of unseemly activity. And I do want to just note that you also document it's a family affair. There were other Bidens who were also profiting from the vice president's position, even I think going back to the days when he was a United States senator. But the thing that is most glaring here is what you have chronicled in terms of the active help that Hunter Biden, the son of the vice president of the United States, gave to the Chinese Communist Party, and as you say, even the Chinese Communist Party's armed forces, the People's Liberation Army, through transactions that flowed from $1.5 billion that were given to Hunter Biden by the Chinese to invest. Give us, I think, perhaps a particularly gripping example of this was the investment that Hunter's firm made in a Chinese company that was actively stealing America's nuclear secrets. Tell us about that, if you would, Matt.
Yes. So in 2014, Bohai Harvest, which was the company that Hunter Biden received this $1.5 billion investment from the Chinese government, became an anchor investor in CGN, or China General Nuclear. And for years, they had been stealing nuclear secrets through a man named Alan Ho, who had been actually, he was being investigated by the FBI, both the company and Alan. And he was, he went to jail eventually. And so the thing that's so egregious about this is that this is a Chinese-owned nuclear facility, and only Hunter Biden could get the stake in the company. Nobody else could do that. And the question is, how does he get there? How does he get this special treatment? And again, this is one example, and this is a very egregious example, because Bohai Capital, or Harvest, I'm sorry, made a whole series of investments, and I think they're all quite egregious. But this one is especially bad because it does put our national security in grave, grave danger. And for what? For a 10% holding in some company? There are other companies you can get 10% holdings in that don't threaten the lives of our troops, that don't threaten the lives of Americans. This will be the son of the potential commander-in-chief, which I think is extremely dangerous for the long haul.
And there's so much to talk about in this regard, and we have to take a short break in just a moment. But suffice it to say that we're talking about not just a company that was stealing America's nuclear secrets. You're talking about companies that were engaged in manufacture of technologies for our Defense Department, dual-use technologies in some cases. You're talking about companies that were or are involved in the surveillance state apparatus of the Chinese Communist Party that it uses to oppress its own people and violate human rights. I mean, you're talking about really egregious actions here that this individual, this son of the then Vice President of the United States, seemingly had no trouble undertaking, profited handsomely by, evidently, but was doing it clearly at the expense of the national interest, the national security interest, not least. We have to take this break. When we come back with Matthew Taylor, we're going to talk about what did Joe Biden know and when did he know it about these deplorable, well, I would actually suggest treasonous activities of his son Hunter. And what can we infer from how that might affect his future conduct were he to become president of the United States? Stay tuned for more with Matt Taylor, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting for this second segment with Matthew Taylor, a highly accomplished filmmaker, among others, the director of Hillary the Movie, which was not only a terrific piece of filmmaking, I had a cameo appearance in it myself, to be honest, but it made Supreme Court history and changed the course of elections for quite some time. Let me ask you, Matt Taylor, first of all, thank you again for being with us and giving us a second segment to talk further with you. With respect to this film, Riding the Dragon, and what you reveal about the Bidens' China secrets, it's horrific. I think there's no other way to describe it. What Hunter Biden did the question that I think is top of mind is, could he possibly have been doing these deals, have been making this kind of money, have been traveling and interacting with these various Chinese nationals without his father being aware of what he was up to?
There is no doubt in my mind that Joe Biden 100% knew what his son was up to. And the reason is that, again, Hunter received deals that the Deutsche Bank and these other places could not get. He received shareholder positions and cash that any kind of bank in America or anywhere in the world would die for. And the only way that you can be walked into these places is with somebody who has such massive political power. And of course, Joe Biden took over the Asia pivot in late 2011, early 2012, and became in charge of this region and was doing the negotiations, whether it was over IP theft, whether it was in the South China Seas. And so Joe Biden had a lot of bargaining power with the Chinese, and hence he could make, you know, deals that allowed his son to get deals that nobody else could have. He had leverage, which is, you know, this again is part of the pattern.
It is the pattern for Joe Biden. It's also the pattern, of course, for the Chinese, Guangxi, I think they call it, which is connections. You know, they're giving people favor treatment because they can be helpful to them. So if Joe Biden knew that his son, for example, was making a deal that involved a company that was stealing America's nuclear secrets, just to pick one, that would make him complicit in a criminal enterprise. Would you go that far, or is there not the proof positive to demonstrate that, but suspicion nonetheless that it was so?
I mean, we do state in the film that the Bidens probably did not know about the espionage within CGN particularly, but it doesn't matter because they definitely knew that purchasing Hennigus in Michigan would put Americans out of work. They knew that that was dual-use technology. They knew that AVIC, the company that bought 51% of that company, was building the very same fighter jets that would kill American troops were we go to war over the South China Seas. So they knew that that technology is sensitive, and it's critical to, say, build F-35s. And we were, in fact, handing over some of this technology to the Chinese. And so whether they knew about the espionage, that is a much more difficult case to make. What they know about Hennigus in Michigan, well, that is very clear because the U.S. government had to sign off on some of these deals.
And did under Joe Biden's management of the China portfolio. So this brings me to a larger point that we talk about a fair amount on this program, Matt, and I think your film is sort of states exhibit A. Hunter Biden may have been a particularly egregious case or have gotten particularly favored treatment from the Chinese Communist Party. But I think it's fair to say that there are quite a number of people on Wall Street and companies on Wall Street that are at the moment in hot pursuit of similar kinds of opportunities and deals and willing to do whatever it takes to get them. And I'm thinking in particular of four major investment banks at the moment that are involved in a prospective initial public offering of a company in China called Ant Technology Group that is expected to bring to the Hong Kong and Shanghai capital markets the largest initial public offering in history. And Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley and Citigroup are four of the five lead managers on that IPO. And our Committee on the Present Danger China just yesterday sent three different letters to the Hong Kong Stock Exchange, to these four companies, and to the President of the United States, raising real concerns that profoundly worrying material risks associated with this Ant Group are not being properly disclosed to investors. And with the help of these companies, we will see probably tens of millions of Americans having their savings, their pension funds and so on, invested in this company that helps the military of China, helps the surveillance state, steals private and personal data and so on. And it's scandalous, just as Joe Biden's son's behavior is scandalous, only arguably it's happening on an even greater scale, especially when you look at other transactions that such Wall Street companies are also engaged in. So I just would ask you, Matt, to comment on that problem, because it's egregious in the way that you've documented here. It's particularly worrying because Joe Biden did seem to be at least complicit in some of these deals. And he might do much more and much worse were he to become president. But isn't it really telling us something about the state of American capitalism that it is all in for what is, I believe, our most serious enemy in the history of our country?
Absolutely. I mean, look, politics is about precedent, right? And the thing that's interesting about how Hunter operated under his father is it created the roadmap for anybody to do these kinds of things. If the vice president and his son are complicit in transferring technology and making money off the backs of hardworking Americans, well, then why shouldn't a bank, right? Why shouldn't they do it as well, right? They've removed anything goes. And again, it's the pattern. They showed the pattern. They did the, because here's the thing. I tell people, you know, everybody asks me, why are they not being indicted, et cetera, et cetera? Because technically what they did is not illegal. But most people are usually held back because this is the number one enemy of the United States. But if the vice president is willing to do that, well, then why wouldn't everybody be willing to do that? Because these are public servants. And they're supposed to be our ethical guide in how this country operates. And why not follow the vice president's son example? Because if he's going to make $1.5 billion from the Chinese, then what's the big deal if Goldman Sachs does? And so I think it sets a bad precedence that we've seen, whether it's the Clintons or the Bidens.
It's rife, that's for sure. And one other thing, which I don't think features in the film, but it's worth noting, is that Joe Biden actually helped engineer a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese Communist Party that enabled all of those companies to invest in Chinese entities without those Chinese companies or corporations having to comply with our securities laws. So making them even more of a pig in the poke. This is another of these scandals that needs attention. I did want to reserve a little bit of time, and it's not much, but I wanted to commend you because at the same time you were pushing this film out, somehow, Matt Taylor, you managed to get another one, a feature-length documentary film entitled Safeguard, an Electoral College Story. This institution is poorly understood by most of us. It plays a hugely important role, and it'll be very interesting to see what, if anything, it's able to do in connection with this election. Tell us your insights into that, and we'll come back to you for a longer discussion of it soon, but give us the short form, if you could.
Absolutely. You know, the Electoral College is something people only think about every 4 years, and they don't even think about it that much, and they don't have a good understanding of what it's designed to do. And it's designed to protect minority voters, whether you're a racial minority, a sexual minority, an economic minority, whether you're a minority state, whether you live in a state with only 500,000 people, like a Wyoming. And so we decided to make a project that shows what it is and how it works and how it protects individual rights over the rule of the mob. And the film is not a partisan film. It's just a film about the education and the system and why it's here. But it will play a greater role as the system is currently under attack and people are trying to get rid of the Electoral College and turn it over to a national popular vote, which would be devastating for people who live all over the country or for anybody who is in the minority on any kind of minority of any sort. So how it plays out in this election, the Electoral College will save us from a potentially disastrous election if it is allowed to play out the way it is designed.
Just so we're clear, there is the possibility that the Electoral College will not be able to operate because of some states withholding the delegations to it. Is that how you see this playing out, or is it just not clear at the moment?
I think at this moment it is not clear. But I do think that there will be electoral paths that will probably be landslides in either direction, depending on who wins. And that is actually why the Electoral College is great, because it does take a mandate. You may win by 100,000 votes, but you could win by 60 or 70 electoral votes, and that creates a mandate. That's how Kennedy won in 1960. Otherwise, he wouldn't have not have been president because the vote was so close. But his electoral landslide was huge.
And shaped his presidency. Yeah, it's not just Donald Trump had that happen to him. And I think we'll be hopeful that this electoral college system is not rendered ineffective in this or any future election, because you're absolutely right. And thank you for telling the story about how important this institution is in Safeguard, an electoral college story. And also, Matt, of course, thank you for Riding the Dragon, the Biden's China Secrets as well, and for spending some time with us talking about both. We'll look forward to visiting with you at greater length soon. You can see Riding the Dragon at BidenFilm.com for free on YouTube. Come back to us with Peter Schweitzer if you can. Next up, we will speak with Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired, a very distinguished military officer, as well as a businessman and a policy wonk, in the best sense of that word. These days, I'm pleased to say, with the Center for Security Policy as a senior fellow. He's also a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. We're always privileged to catch up with him, and we're doing so right now. Grant Newsom, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir. You had a piece in the Asia Times the other day, Grant, that seemed to be rather prescient. I believe you've been vindicated by the current Prime Minister of Japan as to who Prime Minister Abe's successor will be. And it looks as though it's going to be Yoshihide Suga. Tell us about him and what this change portends, when it's going to happen, first of all, and particularly what the United States ought to be doing with the new future leader of Japan.
Okay, well, Suga is a typical politician in Japan. And by that, I mean that he's domestically focused. And that he's not known for his foreign affairs expertise. Although he's certainly been well aware and directly involved in everything that Prime Minister Abe has done.
As he has served as his chief cabinet secretary, I gather, for quite some time.
Yes, that's right. And that's like the chief of staff. So he knows what Abe wanted to do. He knows what's been done. And he's been involved behind the scenes. But as noted, he's not considered a guy with a lot of experience or interest even in foreign affairs. But that just means that he's got an opportunity to take up the job and get things done. So I'm actually reasonably confident that if the U.S. gets in and does its best to meet with him, talk with him, help educate him even, and show we're interested, that he can pretty much continue what Abe has been doing.
Which, on balance, you would rate highly, as I recall.
Well, Abe tried, and he did a couple of fundamentally very good things, particularly changing some of the laws and in the interpretations of them so that Japan can theoretically help the United States more readily. But in concrete terms of improving Japan's defense capabilities, that remains a work very much in progress. But one of the concerns with Suga is that within the LDP, within the Japanese government, there is a strong pro-China faction. And there's a concern that since that faction gave him their support so he could win the election for prime minister, that he may be beholden to them. And so thus, it's very important that the United States gets in and makes it clear that it's an ally like it's always been, and explains why, and also explains what's necessary for Japan to do.
And in this piece, you say that the U.S. government had actually an alternative candidate as a preference, the current defense minister, Tara Taro Kono. Do you think that that may impede our ability to have the kind of relationship that is clearly needed, as you say, with Suga now that he has been elected with the help of the pro-China faction?
I don't think it will. The U.S. had its preference, but with Japanese prime ministers, historically, if you don't like one, just wait 10 minutes and you'll get another one.
Not true of Abe. He had quite a run, didn't he?
Well, he threw off the curve. This was quite a run. Kono will be prime minister eventually. The point is to take what you have and keep them close and help them understand what's in our best interests and what's in Japan's best interests.
Well, let me turn to a related topic in terms of our best interest and Japan's, and that is a relationship between not only the United States and Japan, but between the United States, Japan, and South Korea. And this has been greatly complicated, of course, by the decisions that have been taken of late by Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea. We were talking earlier about the sort of revolt of a large number of prominent diplomats and other foreign ministry officials, ex-foreign ministry officials about this. But Grant, talk about it, because you have made a point on this program and elsewhere of impressing upon us the importance of this tripartite relationship, and in particular, the information sharing that is vital to, you know, an alliance defense posture.
Yes, this tripartite Japan, U.S., Korea defense structure for Northeast Asia is very important, both from an operational sense and a political sense, and even a psychological sense. And the intelligence sharing agreement is a part of that. And there's an operational advantage, because if you can share information smoothly and quickly, it allows you to respond or preempt or take care of things quickly as well. But if you have to go through a very complicated step that slows things down, that's common sense tells us that's not good. It also shows that if you've got a three-way relationship, if two of the parties, or at least one of the parties, hates one of the others, what kind of a relationship do you have? So there's a symbolic aspect to this, in addition to the simple intelligence sharing aspect.
You've written that in addition to that being a problem, the fact that Japan is not part of our most intimate intelligence sharing relationship, known as the Five Eyes Pact, basically the Anglophone powers of Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Britain, and the United States, the so-called Five Eyes. You've argued for Japan becoming part of really Six Eyes. How would that work? And would that offset, in your estimation, Colonel Newsom, the problems that we're seeing currently between Japan and the South Korean government that is going to clearly impede the intelligence sharing that is vital to our mutual defense?
Yeah, it would help. Obviously, it would help Japan and the other Five Eyes to share information. That's obvious. And Japan does have some niche capabilities, particularly in terms of maritime intelligence, that we could find very, very useful. And it, once again, there's a political aspect to it. When you take in another country into the most sensitive intelligence arrangement, and you show that you've got the trust and you treat them like equals, but it also requires Japan to step up, and it's got to improve its classification system, it's the way it handles sensitive information, but also it needs to improve its overall military capabilities. If it's going to be treated like that much of an equal. But if I had to trade one or the other, I would probably be inclined to somehow hope for the Japanese and the South Koreans getting along. And because you do see a troubling sign in the Moon administration that they actually they don't mind breaking away from the United States, unifying with North Korea, and aligning with China. And that's the bigger concern to me at the moment.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And what we've talked with you and Lawrence and many others about over the past few years has been, as you say, Colonel, this sort of very assiduous, deliberate, incremental, but steady movement of Moon Jae in that general direction with obvious, ominous implications, most especially for the people of South Korea. And just very quickly, Grant, you recently were on the ground there looking into how Moon Jae-in has managed to achieve intensified and perhaps determinative political power through voting fraud. That's also of concern, of course, especially if it's a model for what we may be experiencing here shortly. Very briefly, thoughts on that?
Yes, I had gone something of a skeptic, but after looking into it, I think the allegations of voting fraud in the April 2020 election in South Korea are credible. And that was a little bit of a surprise to me, because elections have strange outcomes all the time. But this one, when you look into it, see the evidence, see how level-headed the people raising the information, the claims are, that you've got to have some real concerns. And they have put their most serious challenges, they put them out for rebuttal, and nobody's taken them up on it. That tells you something.
Election fraud does happen, and the question is whether it's not just someplace else, but using some of the same techniques, whether it will be happening here very shortly. Grant Newsom, thank you for raising the alarm and for your insights on all of these issues. We value them tremendously and appreciate your visits. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Dinah West will join us straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome. We are back with one of the women who is a feature of this program, and her visits with us are always a highlight of it each week. She is Dinah West, the author of several really important books, including most recently The Red Thread, The Search for Ideological Drivers in the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. She is also the woman who brings us DinahWest.net and periodic publications elsewhere, but we treasure our time with her, and I'm particularly pleased to have her today because there's a lot to talk about. Dinah West, welcome back. So you have a piece at DinahWest.net that caught my eye. It has a title that sort of riffs off of something, and I'm going to quote it at length because it's important. Ronald Reagan talked about every generation facing an existential threat to freedom. It's not passed on to them through the bloodstream. It has to be fought for and protected and turned over to them to do the same. And then he went, in one riff at least, on to say, or else we'll spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was like to live in the United States when men were free. So you have a piece about a woman by the name of Adela Rogers St. Johns and a book she wrote entitled final verdict. Talk about it as a prism through which to look at this challenge of when Americans were free and what we are now and what's coming.
This book is a memoir of Adela Rogers St. John's father, whose name was Earl Rogers, and in the early part of the 20th century, very early, from say 1900 on to the next 10, 20 years, he was the preeminent criminal defense attorney in the state of California, at a level of celebrity and notoriety and fame that is hard even to fathom today. But what she does in terms of this wonderful description and kind of record of her life with her father, she had a very close relationship with him from a very early age. She takes a step back at a certain point in her narrative to explain what it was like in California at this time, around 1910. And I was absolutely, you know, just kind of knocked off my feet by her description, because she was describing an America that does not exist at all. And I'm not just talking about nostalgia for a simpler time. It was nothing. It's nothing like that. There's a very distinct feature of our life that is gone, and it is what I was thinking about it in terms of the space to develop the American personality, the space to be free. It's the space free of the state. And I think so many of us, all of us, I would even hazard, feel this tremendous oppressive presence of the state in our everyday life now after the corona tyranny, I call it, kicked in, to the point where, just to even fast forward through what we've been through, just the mask itself, the mandated mask, is the government interfering in our every breath. I mean, this is kind of where I am in terms of look, literally. And what she's describing at the same time, it's 100 plus few years away, not that long. She's describing a time when she says the public interest in national affairs, politics, and activities was so small, I have difficulty believing it myself. Most of us knew most of the time who was president, but I can't say we cared much. And she goes on to discuss how weeks could go by in California without a story from Washington on the front pages of the newspapers out there. And she kind of takes you through what this was like, but you start to think about it in terms of the relief from actually having our own lives so tightly tied into the fortunes and fates of the national players.
To say nothing of the dictates, which I think is really your central point here, the dictates of the state or of these political operatives. So, Dinah, this brings me to the second topic that I wanted to address with you. You tweeted about a report that Facebook will remove all of the posts alleging the fires in Oregon were, quote, started by certain groups, unquote. And there are two pieces to this. One is, you know, just what are the facts? And why is the FBI denying those facts? And why is Facebook saying they're not facts and they won't be reported as part of the marketplace of ideas, let alone, you know, the use of information that the public has a need to know by anyone who wishes access to it?
Well, it's the marketplace of censorship at this point, and this is something that we've been tracking for such a long time that the shocking piece of it is the FBI piece of it that comes, again, without sufficient time for investigation, without an effort to really ascertain what is going on the ground and why it is, for example, that these horrendous fires seem to stop at the Canadian border. I mean, this is sort of one of these miracles of nature and climate change that it, on these five feet away, it's a completely different world. But this creation of big tech censorship that has taken what was possible on a much more technologically primitive state in the Soviet Union, in East Germany, in Nazi Germany, in Albania, you know, name your totalitarian system, taken that effort to control what people know and added this layer of technological conditioning that has just just utterly wreaked havoc with the American mind.
Again, something completely foreign to the people of the early 20th century. Let me just ask you about this, though, Dinah, because one of our colleagues, Colonel John Mills, who I'm hoping we'll have on the show tomorrow, now United States Army retired, fellow with a long pedigree in the Special Operations Forces, reports that public information indicates that there are at least four individuals of known connections to Antifa, to Black Lives Matter, or other extremist organizations who have been apprehended and are charged with setting some of these fires. Now, that's four out of about 10 that have been arrested to date. The number may actually be a little higher, but the point is, that's just factual information. And to say otherwise, whether you're the FBI, which has made a practice, Dinah, and you've documented this extensively over the years, of denying that jihadists engaged in terrorism were jihadists engaged in terrorism. Nothing to see here, folks. There's no terrorism here. Now they're doing this apparently with respect to Antifa and BLM. This is a problem in its own right, of course. But to the extent that it is now being enforced, as you say, by big tech, really is extraordinarily troubling, especially in an environment like this, where people's ideas or thinking or decisions, most especially, about who to vote for in the next presidential election, or for that matter, down ballot races, will be shaped by what they're told by these Facebook and other social media platforms, no?
Absolutely, and this is where we have to really open up our minds and consider the horrific possibility that the FBI and these other authoritative entities are actually accessories of Antifa, colluding with, enabling, certainly not infiltrating and destroying. I mean, this is the horror of it, you know, and this is where you get to this this kind of dystopic moment that we're in, where you cannot trust the scientific authorities, the government authorities, the police, the FBI. I mean, this is moment of revelation, you know, horrific revelation that we are sort of trying to work through in this information-packed revelation about revolution. And it's when you actually see the badge involved, you know, the FBI badge involved in these kinds of things, which we are used to at this point. You're exactly right to reference the suppression of jihad that the FBI was so deeply engaged in, and the rise of Antifa. I mean, a real FBI would have, we've talked about this, the real FBI would have wrapped this up a long time ago. I mean, this is not something they should be arresting people now after they have destroyed the nation. They should have been in ahead of this, understanding what was going on, because that is actually why we spend so much money and give them so many powers over us. They are supposed to protect us.
They are indeed, Dinah West, and this brings us back to what Reagan said. We will spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was like to live in a United States where the FBI helped keep us free, instead of perhaps being party to the effort to take us down. Dinah, we have to leave it at that. There is so much more to talk with you about, but it will be for next week. In the meantime, thank you for these important insights and markers down. I know you'll keep up the good work and come back to us soon, as I hope will the rest of you, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.